Welcome everybody to another episode of the Blue Skies Dronecast. Now I just wanted to come on before the episode begins properly to just apologise about the audio quality of this episode. Unfortunately we had a few microphone problems which we didn't really realise until after the episode was recorded. The content's still there, it's just obviously a little bit lower quality than we would like. But with that out of the way, this is obviously a special two-part episode, so be sure to catch the next episode in a couple of weeks' time. Without further ado, we'll let past Tom carry on.
Presented this week, as always, by Tom and Adam. So welcome along, everyone, to another episode. We've got a very special guest, actually, on this episode. We've got Daniel Shen-Smith. You might have heard of his name, but you also might have heard of his sort of alter ego, I suppose, really, the Black Belt Barrister on YouTube. So welcome along, Daniel. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you for being here.
Good, brilliant. So we normally start off with guests in the same sort of fashion, really. We always sort of start off with how they kind of got into the industry and then talk about kind of what they've been doing. And it's going to be the same for this episode, but we've also got a few sort of main topics we're going to cover, which I think hopefully all of our listeners will find super interesting. I know me and Adam will. So like I mentioned, we'll kick off like normal, really, with Daniel giving us sort of his overview of how he actually got into the industry and how it all started. So it was about 7 years years ago, Daniel, wasn't it? How did it all kick off then?
Yes, about 7 years ago. So I had an interest in all things toys generally. And so I started off with the old DJIs and decided to try and build some of those myself. It was sort of a spin-off for YouTube. So I decided to film the making, construction and everything else. That was airborne filming, which, no pun intended, didn't really get off the ground. But it's still live. But cool. I haven't really put much effort into that. Obviously, my YouTube career went elsewhere into law as a barrister.
I see. Yeah, that's good. So you learn all sort of the soldering techniques and the sort of the tuning and bits and pieces too, because I've obviously come from a very similar background. So it's all super interesting. And I think it's, I did like that sort of thing. It's obviously different now, isn't it, unfortunately? But I think you learn a lot in those early days.
Yes, indeed. And the size and the complexity, well, lack of complexity these days, they're much, much smaller and easier. Whereas beforehand, learning what all the components do and how to put them together and everything else. That was a learning curve, and I think it was worth it because it forces you to understand how these things are working in the first place.
When
you get the simpler ones, at least you know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's right. It does help, definitely. Yeah. So from the F550, obviously the DJI aircraft, where did you go from there? Did you sort of carry on with, you know, Phantoms and stuff as some people do, or how did it carry on?
No, I didn't actually. Not for a while. Funny story, because I'm a barrister, I'm obviously keeping an eye on the law and everything else. So when I had the larger one, I was looking at the law and I just knew the laws were going to be constricted quite severely, quite quickly. When people start flying them over airports and things like that, you just know that it's only going one way. So I actually decided at that point to sell it. So I sold it to someone in the armed forces in Germany somewhere. and then I decided to just wait until something smaller, less restrictive came along, and as the Mavic Mini did. And when I looked at the weight categories, I thought they will come out with something just underside that. And that's what they did.
Just holding out for those EASA regulations to be adopted.
Yes, indeed. That was it.
Yeah, brilliant. No, that's interesting to hear, actually. I think that aircraft has really brought a lot of people into the industry, actually, with regards to its weight and what you can do with it, which we might touch upon in this episode. But again, our listeners should know all of that anyway. So that was kind of the drone side of it and how you got into that. So, Adam, maybe you want to sort of take over and carry on with what Daniel is sort of currently doing, I suppose, really.
Yeah, so you've mentioned that you're a barrister, so obviously we don't need to go into the full kind of, you know, how you got there as such, but, you know, how did you get there and how does it now tie into, why have we now got you here talking about drones?
Yes, indeed. I suppose I could say I'm always interested in a wide variety of different things for my whole life. And so I've always been in business, but business led me to need legal services, which led me to see the opportunity in legal services. This is some 10, 12 years ago when I set up my own barrister chambers. I wasn't a barrister at the time. I became a barrister later because of the interest in doing that. And obviously throughout that time, playing with various toys, you know, I've got the Traxxas car on the side over there, and drone hanging up over here. So all the logistics have come together, and I'm interested in the lore behind it and obviously building them, flying them. And then we come together here. So the YouTube channel allows me to have that variety of talking about different things, different laws, different gadgets, how they apply, and largely helping people to understand it. That was the real key behind the channel.
Yeah.
Because I feel it's very often misunderstood.
I was going to ask you sort of, why did you set up that YouTube channel? And I mean, you've kind of already answered it, but I do, if nobody's actually listened to your channel before, you know, search for Black Belt Barrister on YouTube and you will show up. You've got, last time I checked, about 135,000 followers, which is amazing.
Yes.
But I can see why, because it's nice that you don't talk, there is a bit of legal jargon in there, obviously there has to be, but you just say it plainly, you know, you just say as it is and argue for the user rather than it being, you know, I suppose some people think, lawyers, barristers, you know, it's more, I suppose, more negative connotations, I suppose, more associated with that. You come across as, and I'm sure you are, you're on the side of the people. These are your rights. This is actually what you should do to potentially challenge if something happens.
Yes, exactly. It's for the user perspective. I'm a big promoter of, you know, consumer information, consumer knowledge. So if we are the ones at the end of it using the law, using products that are governed by law, we should understand it. And if you, the Consumer Rights Act was supposed to simplify and codify the consumer regulations, the consumer law, all consumer law from European law and bring it all together. But if I just bring up the Consumer Rights Act, it's 142 pages. So it's a long act, but it is fairly simple. But because I think the length of it, people won't read it. And I think the same is true for many others.
Yeah,
it's a bit like the CAP 722.
Yeah,
so absolutely.
Here's the guide to the drone regulations.
Exactly.
I think at one point there was a simplified guide to consumer claims written by a judge at some point, and the simplified guide was about 600 or 700 pages long. So no one probably read through all of that. So I thought the YouTube channel sort of bought out of the lockdown, I suppose, with more time on my hands. But I kept it going. So I squeezed it in around my normal work. You know, I finished a conference immediately before this and I've got one immediately afterwards. So,
oh, right.
it's literally squeeze in. But it's really, the idea is to help the end user at the end of the day.
Yeah. And you cover a vast range of topics. Obviously, you know, this drone is a very small part of actually of what you've got on there. But I noticed that you cover things like, obviously, privacy, which we will chat about, and, you know, photography laws or laws associated with taking photographs, and, you know, driving laws. I saw one the other day, which actually about if you get pulled over by the police, you know, and then what an appropriate thing perhaps you should do or not.
Which yes, say or not say, exactly.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. No, it's great. And I think it's nice to have someone, as we've mentioned, you know, talking about drones as well as the law, because it comes up time and time again for us, and you know, we as a company have to try and answer as best we can, but even we sometimes get a bit unstuck and have to mention the gray areas and stuff, whereas hopefully you can kind of dig through all of that and hopefully find some sort of answers, you know, whereas we sometimes do struggle. So no, it is good.
Some of them might remain grey, but at least there'll be some way of tackling it.
Yeah, exactly. That's super important as well. So we'll briefly just focus on the YouTube channel, actually, because it is very interesting. So where did that sort of stem from, and how did you kind of choose your name? How did that come about as well?
My original channel is Black Belt Secrets, which started out with martial arts for pretty much the same reason. I've been teaching for many years, training for over 30. So I'm a sixth degree black belt. And when I was teaching for many years, people wanted one-to-one sessions, which is the most useful. But I didn't have the time for the amount of people that wanted those one-to-one sessions. So I started the YouTube channel. So Black Belt Secrets, the idea being that the secrets of martial arts and people can, you know, expose these secrets to improve your training. Over time, that sort of spread out a little bit to some sort of products, reviews and things like that. During the lockdown, I had the same idea with law. And to answer these questions, people have, again, in a simple form, but for the masses. And I wanted to incorporate Black Belt in there somewhere because of my other channel. So it's a sister channel, and Black Belt Barrister is a natural choice. That was the idea, really. But and with more time during the lockdown to talk about these things to help people understand, it was ideal.
I see. Yeah. Because obviously, like we've already touched upon, you've obviously a very busy man. So obviously lots to do. So it's actually quite hard to fit in. I think you do a video a day almost, I think. So we've seen. So fitting
at
in
at least
that,
try.
Yeah, that's it. That's the main thing. Yeah, to try. Yeah. But to fit that into effectively a full-time job as well. Obviously, lockdown helped, like you mentioned. But how do you is it more evening work and sort of other times, or are you just very sort of very good at being able to segregate your time and choose what you want to do?
Yeah, it's a combination, really. I have always been good at just getting something done and being at the right place at the right time. Somehow it comes together. There is a lot of there's a combination of just do it whenever I have the time, whenever I have the idea, or planning it ahead. So sometimes they will be planned days or weeks ahead and recorded and done but not released. And so it's a combination of all of those. Newsy stuff is easier because it's just there and then. But what I call the evergreen videos, which is a little bit like the drone videos, although they will change over time. But a video with, you know, the rights to privacy and all these sort of things, they will stay the same for quite a while until there's a major development.
Yeah, I see. They're relevant for a long time too, aren't they, I suppose? Yeah.
And I've got better at it as well, so it doesn't take me as long. So when I first started creating these videos, it would probably, you know, it would take me half a day sitting around thinking about what to say. And I've never scripted anything. Even in court, I don't like to script in court either. A lot of barristers do. I don't. So nothing is scripted. Nothing is planned in that sense. I have a set amount of stuff that I need to cover, but I won't write out what I'm going to say. That would take far too long.
Yeah, that's it. It sounds a bit more natural then, doesn't it, too? We've kind of come across that side of things. So, yeah, it's interesting how you can kind of carve your own sort of way of doing things, actually. It's good.
Yeah.
Do you have a, just going a little bit off topic, do you have sort of a permanent studio kind of in your house? And I can sort of see maybe you do, but that helps, doesn't it?
Yeah, so this is a sort of an everything room for me. It's a gym. It's my workplace. It's now my studio as well. So you can probably see some of the foam on the ceilings here.
Yeah, I saw that.
So, and the walls obviously behind me. But it's a nice place to put my YouTube play button as well in the background.
Oh yeah, look at that. Yeah, nice. That must be an occasion when you get one of those, I should think.
That's nice. Yes, actually. And you can't see it from here, but that one is the Modern Law Awards. So they have a huge ceremony every year. And many of the country's top firms go to this, but I was awarded Marketing and Communication Strategy Award of the year, beating some fairly reputable firms to it. So
super. So that's a great
was that because of your YouTube channel, sort of having that. Yeah, fantastic. Just goes to show the power of the internet.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's it. Adam, do you want to carry on with a couple more questions?
Yeah. So. So we'll start to move on to, coming back down to drones. So obviously on your YouTube channel, you do have a playlist, and obviously there's a couple of playlists that are associated. We've mentioned that there's a photography one, which links back into drones.
Yeah.
But we're going to specifically talk about drones today, and obviously we're going to talk about sort of privacy, a bit of trespass potentially. A big one, which actually always comes up, is about... council land, you know, obviously.
Yes.
That's the place where a lot of people actually probably fly their drones from, whether it's because most people, it's either the back garden, if they legally can do so with their particular drone, or it's potentially from a park or other privately or council owned land. So the sort of big, I suppose, the big question, and we know you've done a video on this, but it's probably worth rehashing because it always comes up, no matter if the information's out there. Can a council or a local council, can they ban drones? Can they, but actually, can they ban drones outright on all council land?
So there's two stages to this, really. There's the two parts of the question. Can they do it? And if they do it, is it lawful or enforceable? And I think that the two are to be approached slightly differently. So they can is the answer to the first one. They can ban them. But that doesn't mean that's the end of the matter. It can be challenged. And there's a number of ways it can be challenged. And there's two principal ways that they could be banned. The second is probably less common. It was certainly less common, and probably I would say less robust. Although on the face of it, it might appear robust, but I think ultimately would be less so, and I'll explain why. But the first way would be with a bylaw. So if a council, and most people recognise these with things such as, you know, not walking your dog in a certain area, not drinking in a certain area, not an area, or et cetera, these kind of things. Just bylaws, locally created laws, if you like, that the government can create, the local authority can create under devolved government powers. But there's an important, if a council did create one of these bylaws to ban drones, the next question is, well, is it lawful? So what a bylaw should not do is to restrict something that already has legislation in place. And so if there is already legislation either controlling, prohibiting, or even permitting something from being done in that area, a bylaw shouldn't supersede that, or shouldn't even be created. And so where you have drones, the question of drones, the CAA, of course, the sole body for regulating airspace, they have this position to create the law and inform on the law, and the law is already there. As we've mentioned, no doubt we'll talk about briefly with the navigation order. And so those requirements, those restrictions are already set out. And so a bylaw should not seek to legislate for that, which has already been dealt with.
Yeah, so obviously as part of the new implementing regulations that came out that we adopted in 2021, there is a set boundary for obviously the subcategories, the A1, A2, A3. Obviously the regulations don't go specifically about land, but the regulations are based on obviously weight categories. So the CA basically say that if it's a very small drone, sub 250 gram drones, you can fly it close to people. And obviously if it's larger drones or more risk associated drones, it drops into the A3 subcategory, which means you have to fly it far from people, so usually in rural locations, nice big open land, not so much a park but open, big open land. So there is already, I suppose, set boundaries there. Again, they don't touch on specifically private or council owned land, but it is all based on this risk. So is that already, is this what you're kind of talking about, that there's already something there that says whether you should or shouldn't be flying, but it's not based on, well, I suppose it is based on a location, it's just not specific on council or private.
Indeed. And the argument about land, which I think no doubt will come on to separately later, as to whether it's public or private, that's a separate argument entirely. So the restrictions on where you can fly in respect of people, or how far from people, as you say, near, far, over, and so on, that's the main restriction. So when looking at a bylaw, there must be a number of things to be valid. Otherwise, they can be challenged if they are not. This is why I say that the council could create the bylaw, but if it could be challenged in a certain way, then the court can either quash it or revert it to the council to think about it again. And so they must be reasonable. If it's not reasonable, it's not valid. It's got to be within power, so they would have to have the power to make that law in the first place. There's an argument whether or not the local authority have the power to restrict something that is ultimately the jurisdiction of the CAA. there's an argument there. Also, you know, if it's manifestly unjust or something like that. So if it were outright banning, let's say, use something else as an example, if a council were to ban dog walking everywhere on any land that it controls, that would be manifestly unjust. No real, and it would be unreasonable as well. And therefore, for all those reasons, it would a challenge would be successful. And, you know, it must be certain, but it also must be consistent with existing legislation. So I think the key there is it must be consistent with existing legislation. And in this case, the rules which are effectively set out by the CAA. So if the legislation currently permits the flying in a certain area, whether it's, you know, urban or rural, a bylaw must be consistent with that. If not, then it can be challenged. So it'd be a collateral challenge is the term. So it'll be challenged by way of judicial review, which in simple terms means you go to court and the judge looks at the situation to decide whether it's right or not. So a judicial review is literally that, a judge looking at the law that's been made by the council and whether it should have or could have made that law in the first place. And all of this is within the Act. It's the Local Government Act of 1972, which allows local authorities to create these bylaws, but Section 235 provides that it cannot make a bylaw where alternative legislation already exists.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Now, I might be jumping the gun here by a couple of things, but it ties back in. So as far as you're aware, has anybody ever gone to a judicial review for a bylaw associated with drones? Has that happened yet? Do we know?
I don't believe so. It certainly hadn't the last time I checked, but I don't think so.
Sort of today we're recording this, 25th of April, as far as we're aware, actually, it's not been challenged as far as we're aware.
As far as I'm aware, at a local level.
That's really interesting, I think, as well. And obviously, going back to the bylaw side of things, how can people find this information? Because I think a lot of people tend to arrive at a location and there'll be a nice big white sign with a picture of a drone with a cross through it, and that's
probably
the first they hear of it. Yeah. So I wonder, can they kind of prepare themselves before that, and where would they go to find these bylaws? You know.
Well, this is a problem, really, because each local authority are obviously responsible for how they create the law, how they inform its constituents as to any laws created. So naturally, they each have their own website, their own way of doing things, their own way of publishing what they've done. I would say keep a lookout on the news section of their websites, because either for a bylaw or for what I was going to come on to, the public space protection orders, but I'll deal with that very briefly shortly. But they should put on their news section, bring to the public's attention any laws like this.
Okay.
And that'll be part of the requirement. Just backtracking, the reason I said I'm not aware of anything, there is another barrister who specialises in local policy law, did look into this area and looked into lots of different local authorities, and said that he couldn't find one of them that was consistent with legislation or enforceable. I'll send you the link to that as well, so your listeners can look at that as well. The other thing I would do, which I've done for my local area, is Google Alerts. So if someone's not familiar, you can create an alert for search results that match certain search terms, certain words, key phrases. So I have those mapped out to ping on any news related to drones in my area. So you can do that obviously for any area and your local authority. That would be worth doing, because it should be published. Someone's going to do that.
Yeah, no, that's great, isn't it? Because otherwise you've got to be, you know, first thing every morning, you know, searching for it. So it's nice if it can actually let you know. That's a great idea as well.
Sure. That's the problem if you're coming into the area, if you're not local to the area, and you go to somewhere and you go, well, this is a nice park. I assume it's a council park. You can usually tell if it's council or public park. But yeah, I mean, obviously you don't just go there and go, you don't just turn up and go, oh God, I'm going to have to look at the website. How do I find out whether I can fly my drone? If there's literally no signs or anything,
yes.
How are you supposed to know whether you can or can't fly it if there's no obvious kind of restrictions? I know in some places there are obviously bylaws on petrol-powered model aircraft. Now, obviously, most drones aren't petrol-powered. They're battery-powered. So in that case, if it states it's petrol-powered, would a drone still come under that bylaw, do you know?
Well, no, it wouldn't. I mean, if something stated that it's petrol powered and this is not, then there's no ambiguity in my view. It's just not petrol powered, so it wouldn't come under the same law.
It's good to know. Right.
Yeah. And lastly, then, kind of before we again move on, if there were bylaws, etc., how would these be kind of enforced? You know, are there people kind of patrolling the areas? You know, there's obviously not very well, I've never seen them do that type of thing, so I wonder how they are enforced if there are these bylaws in these areas.
Yeah, so as you say, there's usually not someone patrolling the area. Most things are not enforced these days in such fashion. So I suppose in reality, if there were someone patrolling and they knew all of the law, which there's a funny story I'll come back to in a minute, but if they were and if they knew the law and they knew that there is a bylaw that prevents it and they could issue a fine and so on, then maybe, but probably not. I think it's more likely if someone is consistently flying in an area which is bordering on nuisance or someone perceives it as a nuisance. But again, there's case law there as well. So I think it's more likely if it's reported and then there's definitive action taken on it. But that's reactive rather than proactive. That sort of crosses boundaries, again, no pun intended, with trespass and nuisance and privacy and things like that. So all of those things come into play. But speaking strictly, forgetting trespass and nuisance and privacy, and strictly as regards to a bylaw, it would depend on someone actually coming out, taking the action and fining somebody for it.
Oh, I see.
And even then it can be challenged. So as with I usually don't recommend people challenge a speeding ticket fixed penalty because most people lose because there's usually no smoke without fire in those situations. But not to say that, you know, sometimes, you know, once in a thousand, maybe the machine wasn't calibrated and that's a valid.
Yes.
But usually not. I think this would be a fairly different situation because if one were given a fixed penalty for flying a drone because there's a bylaw that they didn't know about, for example, I think that there'd be grounds to challenge this on the basis that there is legislation in place which either permits or restricts flight of certain aircraft in certain locations to or from people, certain distances. And if you're following that and there's a bylaw that conflicts with that, then it's already in breach of the Local Government Act because it's contradicting legislation. So I think there will be a challenge to be made there in any event,
which
is probably the perfect place to slip in this public space protection order, which is a little bit like a bylaw, but it's designed to have a quicker process with less consultation, which allows the local authority to act more quickly to prevent something. It was, I think, largely aimed at rough sleeping and encampments and things like that.
Okay.
However, there are also potential challenges to that as well. But firstly, the problem with it would have to be challenged by an interested party, which in this case will be probably someone living in the area, within 6 weeks of it being advertised to be created. Otherwise, it's in place, and in place for probably 3 years. First of all, again, there could be, if you were given a fine under a public space protection order in the same way as a bylaw, one of your defences could be, or defensive action could be, to judicially review that fine on the same basis as before, or use it as a defence under Section 67 of the Antisocial Behaviour, Crime and Policing Act, in that it couldn't, again, similar wording as before, in that this order could not be lawfully used to prohibit or restrict an activity, which should be okay under other legislation. I think that would act as a defence. And I know this is where it starts to sound very complicated. but the bottom line is, coming full circle, that local authority can ban drones, they can give you fines for them, but there are defences and there are challenges.
I see.
Like many other things.
Yeah. And it takes someone to actually challenge it for, you know, other things to then happen, I suppose, doesn't it, too? Which is probably a fairly standard practice, I suppose, as well.
Indeed. And at some stage, somebody will, especially if it's someone like me who's flying a drone, and I'm not shy of challenging these things, obviously.
No, I bet you'd be the last person that they'd want to come up against, you know, either just a drone patrol or even a police officer, actually, because I think we've heard that a lot of people just out on the street, you know, again, don't know the rules, do they? And if they do, they're probably a couple of years behind the times now, obviously, because everything's changed. So, yeah, that's interesting as well, isn't it? Yeah.
And speaking of the police officer, there is a YouTuber who is one of the auditing community, love them or hate them. But he was flying a drone and confronted by a police officer. And I was interested in this play out, obviously, from the legal perspective, for two reasons. I think they're both wrong in their own way.
I see. Yes.
I think the police officer was wrong in the sense that he just didn't understand that drones are legal if you've got it registered and you're flying in the parameters that you're permitted to do. So I think the police officer got that wrong because he didn't understand that. I think he also thought it's a breach of privacy, it's a nuisance, and so on, and trespass, and whatever, all of which it isn't, necessarily, at least. So I think the police officer got it wrong for that perspective. But also then when challenged for, I think this is in a separate video, but challenged for the flyer ID, or the operator ID, rather, that's on the drone. And I think the position, or his argument, was there's no law that says he has to provide that number. The law only says that it's got to be on the drone. And I thought that was quite an interesting, quite a clever challenge, actually.
Yeah.
Ultimately doomed to fail, because I'm fairly certain, and it's not often I say that, but I'm fairly certain that if this were brought to court, the judge would say, well, you should give them the number. Why not? Mm. The number is on the drone for a purpose. The purpose is to identify the ultimate responsible operator for the aircraft. So why not provide someone the number, given the challenge to do so? Council officer, police officer, or whoever. Maybe not a member of the public, I suppose, is where I'd probably draw the line. But if your drone's crashed into their car and they want your operator...
You probably want to take those details for insurance purposes.
There you go. And that's the common sense approach. So I often say, if something makes common sense, it's probably where the law would sit with it.
I see.
So if it makes sense to, if you've crashed your drone into someone's car and dented it, scratched it, whatever, and that person says, you know, who are you? What's the registration number of this drone? It's probably what they would say.
Yes.
And it's the equivalent, the operator ID is the equivalent of a registration number, I suppose. So that's its purpose. And so if you ask the CAA, that will be their view. They will say, well, you should give this number to a police officer or a council officer or whatever. That's what they will say.
And I see.
in my view. That's what a judge would say as well.
Yeah, yeah, because that's how ultimately the drone is identifiable now, isn't it? With that number, it links back to you, your address, your details. So, yeah, like you said, I was going to compare that to a registration on a car. You know, I don't know whether you have to divulge that information, but that's the reason it's on the car in the first place, isn't it? Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's a very interesting question. So, one of the very frequent things that comes up is with vehicle registration numbers. And people saying, oh, it's a breach of data protection, it's a breach of GDPR, and so on and so forth. But it isn't. That's it's actually nonsense with respect.
But
the registration number is there for a purpose. It's to identify who the registered keeper of the vehicle is. And I use the term very carefully because the registered keeper is not necessarily the owner.
No.
It's very often not the driver. But it's the person ultimately responsible for that vehicle. So whether you own it doesn't really matter. Whether you were the one driving it doesn't really matter. It's the person responsible for it. So if I were out flying one of your drones with my flyer ID, with your permission, it's still your drone. And you are the operator. You are the registered operator for the drone. You are responsible for making sure that I am a suitable person to fly your drone and where I'm flying it and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So if you just lent it to a friend who didn't have a flyer ID and crashed it, injured somebody, it would they need somehow to find out, well, who this person was. And so it should come back to you.
Yeah.
And that would also dovetail into another question you had about insurance. Bottom line is, I think, yes, you should have insurance, although you'll probably be covered under your house insurance, but I would always check. But we digress. the vehicle registration. A person's details are registered in the sense of a vehicle with a DVLA, and that's because if you have a crash and you want to find out who it was, or if they drive off, you can find out who it was. Yeah. Anyone can find out who owns a vehicle if they have reasonable cause. It's called a V888 form that you send to the DVLA. And if they believe you've got reasonable cause, you can find out who owns the vehicle. And essentially that will be the position with drones, although, you know, law probably hasn't caught up yet, but
no, that's it. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And if I think back to when they kind of started to promote the whole flyer and operator ID at the CAA, Adam, I think you were there with me, weren't you? They did explain the operator ID. And I think it is on the website. It is almost exactly how you've worded it. You know, who is ultimately in charge of the aircraft? You know, who not necessarily is flying it, but who is the accountable manager almost of the aircraft. So it's very similar, actually,
you kind of already said it. It's like hiring a car. It's like you can hire a car from a company. Now if you speed in that hired car, the people that will be notified is the hire company will then go, well, it was this person driving it. And then it all trickles back down to the pilot, not the operator, because the operator ID. It all trickles back down. It's all about just making sure we can always find out who is ultimately responsible, whether it's not always going to be the operator ID holder. It's the flyer that is the one that is essentially going to be responsible for what happens to it in flight, but it might come back to the operator to find out who was flying that aircraft.
Yes. And it makes sense because if you've got, hobbyists will have one or two drones and it's their own, it's only them that's flying it. But if you now think of for decades, actually, all of those, or any drone flyer will now recognize all of the overhead forest shots, which is obviously either taken by a helicopter, a plane, or in recent decades, drones. Mm. And they carry, you know, cameras like this one around, as opposed to GoPros, which are obviously a lot heavier. But if they've got a big setup like that, they won't have one for each and every flyer. They'll have six or seven flyers.
Mm.
But they need some way of identifying who's responsible for it. And that's the main reason. So
yeah, it makes sense, like you say, doesn't it? Now I think it actually is starting to feel like there's a wave that there's accountability now, which I think is what they were sort of aiming for, I suppose, really, too, which is good.
don't miss part 2 of our interview with the Black Belt Barrister, which will be aired in 2 weeks' time.